Hello, wonderful people from around the world. Let me introduce our guest today, who actually doesn't need introduction, but for the sake of it, let's introduce wonderful John Maeder, who is my personal hero. He worked in design and technology forever and wrote incredible books like The Laws of Simplicity, which was probably one of the first books that I discovered when I was starting in design as something very different and very different approach to design. It looked very different. It talked about design in a very different way. So I connected with it immediately. So for me, it's very slightly surreal now that today I'll be talking to John, my hero. Thank you, John, for joining. And also, John currently is VP of Design and Artificial Intelligence at Microsoft, which is even more incredible. And I have so many questions about what do VPs of Design and Artificial Intelligence do. So we'll talk about that. And in between, writing books and doing design and technology, John, as you probably know, created lots of beautiful artworks. Some of them are even in MoMA, in permanent collections. He constantly talked about connection between design, business, and technology. And these are all the topics that we will be discussing today. Welcome, John. How are you?
Hello. I am good. Thank you, Katharina, for your energy. My gosh, it's end of day. How do you do that? And I like the idea that I've been doing this forever. Technically, maybe it feels like that to me, but it may look like that. And you actually can, if you're on a laptop, watch another TV show while this is happening. So this is a competition. Can this be more entertaining than your other entertainment options? So let's go, Ekaterina.
Well, I love that you started with such a competitive spirit, John. And actually, my first question, is not one question. We have rapid fire questions. So how about we start on a high energy? And I have 10 very quick questions for you. And you need to answer the first thing that comes to your mind. Describe yourself in three words.
Tired, curious, developer.
AI tool that you use the most right now. Tool or plugin or however you want to take.
Foundation models.
Nice. Best movie of all times.
Black Panther.
Love it. Great movie. If you had to pick one, design, technology, or business?
I would pick business because then I could do design and technology because I'm making money.
Smart. Designer or artist you admire the most right now?
The designer I admire the most is Quentin Harris, changing the future of the advertising world.
Great. Well, something for us to deep dive into. Professional achievement you are the most proud of?
Oh, I'm not proud of any personal achievement or professional achievement. I don't think I'm done yet. So I'm still focused on what's next.
I love it. What's next is a great question. What's your guilty pleasure?
Carpets. I just got a carpet that when I stand on, it feels so good. So carpets, standing on a carpet. Feels so good. I mean, but not with shoes on, of course, with like bare feet or whatever. Wow. What a feeling.
I mean, that's probably the best answer I've heard. So thank you for this. Your favorite book?
I'm a fan of Carl Gerstner's Designing Programs. It's probably the first book that described how computation-like things and the visual domain intersect in a good combination of ideas. One is very structured, the other is less structured, and it's that mixture of design and technology that happened before, well, just when computers were emerging in the 60s. So it's a very visionary piece, I believe.
Great. And I have one last question for you. If you could change one thing in the world, what would it be?
If the world were more inclusive, I think that would be a really good thing. I think by design, it's not inclusive. Like, if you're an island, you're going to be kind of, I like my island. If you're in a part of the city that you're comfortable with, you're like, this is my part of the city. So being inclusive is not a natural thing because it takes energy. If you're tired, like me, you're going to get even more tired. So why would you want to test your boundaries of how you think or who you work with or what you're eating or what you're ingesting as information? If everything was like 10x more inclusive, I think a lot of things would be more interesting. And I think things would get a little better in the world.
I couldn't agree more with this answer. And I think inclusivity is probably the most underappreciated feature of design that design can actually provide and help with. And creativity, in my personal opinion. But in general, I think inclusivity could solve so many problems in the world that it's something that good to think about. Well, thank you, John, for answering the rapid fire round of question. We are done with the speedy ones. Now we're going into deep philosophical conversations. And I have so, so many questions. I'm really afraid I won't be able to answer all of them or ask all of them, or you will be answered all of them. But let's begin. Let's try. And my first question to you is about you and about communication. When I was reading your books or watching your lectures, what I found the most fascinating about you, apart from the fact that you know so much, is how well you're able to communicate yourself. It's really inspiring to see how you can take very complex problems or concepts and really break them down so everyone in the room could understand, which is a real superpower for any leader, and especially someone who works in very complex fields like design and technology and innovation and business. So how do you do it, or where do you learn how to communicate yourself so clearly and so well?
Well, it depends who you talk with. Some people would say, like, I have no idea what you're saying, John. So I think a certain kind of audience believes that I'm saying things that make sense to them. I think it's an audience that is closer to culture than to, I think, a purely intellectual view of the world. I like to remind folks that I'm not very smart. I grew up in a family with no books. I really am very non-literate. I read a lot of comic books as a child because that's the only thing we had in our house. My mother had Harlequin romance books, so those I couldn't read them because they were inappropriate. And so the newspaper we had was, in the States, we have something called the National Enquirer. It's a very sensationalist journalism. Elvis is alive, you know. That was always the headline. So I was like, oh, Elvis is alive. Cool. You know, you're a teenager. You don't know what that means, but you're like, you're into it. And so my references are all popular culture. And therefore, I communicate in that language naturally, or more that I'm constrained by it. I'm always very jealous of people who can talk about Descartes or, you know, all these random long name sort of philosophers, which I have no bearings around. So I'm forced to speak in the level that I can communicate in, which to some I think communicates well. And again, it depends who you are.
I love that you spoke about kind of thinking about who you're communicating to. And in terms of when you're preparing for any presentation, or maybe a big keynote speech like you did for TED, or a presentation in front of your stakeholders, Microsoft, how do you prepare or structure or think about what you need to say to make sure they understand you?
You know, I really enjoy the chat or any kind of conversation that's happening in a channel. I don't think what I say matters. It's what everyone else is saying or thinking that matters. If you're a leader, your goal isn't to say a lot. Your goal is to listen a lot. So I like to do a lot of call and response, just sort of understand what people's needs are. Like Dave's like wondering, like, what time was this scheduled at? Even I was making my own mistake about, you know, it's like these questions is like, you could ask someone to care about something, but if they don't care about it, they can't listen. So I was lucky in my 30s that I was working with AARP, which in the United States used to be the major lobby for people over 55. And so in my 30s, I learned about getting old. And it was great. I went to this conference of AARP in Las Vegas. And, you know, there's like someone who's 70-year-old. My friend wanted to show me. He's like, watch this. He said, look up to a 70-year-old person. Oh, you're old. 70-year-old person says, I'm not old. The 80-year-old person over there, they're old. So you go to the 80-year-old person. Are you old? No. The 90-year-old person over there is old. So age is relative. But I bring this up because I also realize that if you are older and you can't get around a lot, you're always talking about your pain in your body. You know, when you talk to someone who used to be very interesting, but now you talk with them and all they can say is like, oh, my back hurts, you know, my foot hurts, or I got surgery, you know, and you think like, wow, they're not as smart and interesting as they were before. It's not that. It's just that their body hurts and that's their point of view. And they can't let in other things that they're thinking about into the conversation. It's kind of like, Ekaterina, if we were together and I were to step on your foot, I wouldn't do that, of course. But you'd be like, John, you stepped on my foot. My foot hurts. What was the question I was going to ask you? And I was like, I wouldn't do that, of course. But it's sort of like when your body is in pain all the time, you don't get to do this. So I'm glad that I'm of the age where I have pains, but on the average, I can communicate and perhaps provide value like this.
Well, you definitely learned that skill very well throughout your life. And one of the things that you mentioned, that the reason why design, for example, is misunderstood because it is so complex and probably people don't communicate it well. So what would you say if someone wants to help someone understand design, if someone works in a company that doesn't understand design and they want to communicate the value of design and the value of creativity, are there any ways you found throughout your career the most helpful ways to go about it?
You know, I spend a lot of my time more as an engineer right now. So I kind of have like a kind of more arm's length view of design that I hadn't had in a while. I kind of started that 4 years ago when I was working in the disaster space as a chief technology officer. So I've been kind of like thinking about design. How valuable is it? When is it valuable? Why do we always have to communicate the value of design? It's like, imagine if you were someone who makes bridges, a bridge across a river. That's what you do. You're an engineer, construction company. Before, nobody could get across the river. So you had to have a boat where you got really wet swimming across the river. But like, hey, you get a bridge. Whoa, that's amazing. Does a bridge fall down when 5 people walk across it? No. 10 people? No. 100 people? How about a car? I like that bridge. It's done. Was there design? Was it designed to be pleasant or all these other factors? Couldn't afford it. Oh, well, that's okay because the bridge works. I think the core value of engineered objects is powerful. It's why engineering is such a vital thing in every company. Design can appear to be value add that costs money. And I think that's where the business mind has to come into the foreground. Design is valuable when you're competing as a commodity. In those cases, which are quite common, where technology is mature, you're competing on, does it feel different? Does it feel better? And I think that's where design has a value play that is more easily communicated. But the language has to be in the language of business. Otherwise, a business person won't understand it. It's kind of like trying to explain why the Bauhaus was an amazing moment in the history of design to a business person, and they don't get it. So you're like, huh, they don't get it. They're not smart. Are they bad people? Are they whatever? No, it's more that they don't care about what you care about. What do they care about? They care about greater top of funnel interest in this new product. They care about greater conversion for being desiring it so much that they'll pay for it. When you communicate in those terms to a business person, great. When you communicate to an engineering person who also has a lot of empathy, do you want your mother to go across a bridge that sort of like wrenches her heart every time she crosses it? So talk to the engineer about how to get out more value of design. And design can do design the way design is done more easily.
That's a bit of a controversial view, I would say, because is there a world where design and engineering are a bit closer together? So it's not an add-on on engineering, but if you start from the design, at the end of the day, is all about how people interact with something. So if you start from that place, then engineering can be better and everything else can be better.
But if you step way back, like I went to visit Paul Rand. He was a graphic designer. He designed the IBM logo, the Westinghouse logo, the ABC logo, the UPS logo, a bunch of famous identities. And some of the companies he designed for are gone. But remember that companies are born and some of them die too, right? Companies are products too. So Rand designed a bunch of famous companies that I knew when I was younger. And I went to visit him at his studio because I had somehow gotten lucky knowing the Paul Rand type person of Japan. And so when I visited Paul Rand in America, it was kind of cool, the real Paul Rand. So I went to New York City, flew there. I got in a train, went to Connecticut, which is near New York, by the way, if you don't know American geography. I don't know European geography so well, so no judgment. And like I remember, like I got to the house, it's way out in the forest, it's like way out, you know? And then it was 8 o'clock. My meeting was from 8 to 8:30. I knocked on the door and this like older gentleman comes out and he starts to get very pushy. He says, you know, hey, my assistant didn't arrive today, so you're going to have to work for free all day. Do you understand? And I was like, okay. And I was already kind of worried because like I got in a taxi and I wasn't sure how I was going to get back to the train station. So I was like, well, I'll figure it out. Now I have more time to figure out how to get back. So, you know, we'll go into studio. He's finishing his last book, From Lascaux to Brooklyn, The Caves of Lascaux, The Markings to His Life Living in Brooklyn, actually as a child. I worked on his the last pages of his book, the last mechanical pages. It was like, you know, 8 a.m., 9 a.m., 10 a.m., 11 a.m., 12. Now, back then, they hadn't invented amazing snack bars like all the young people have now. All these like pocketable snacks. What is this? We never had these snack bars. And so I was very hungry at 12 o'clock. And then it was 12:30. I'm like, whoa, I'm really hungry, awkward. And then suddenly he comes out with a plate with a sandwich, a ham sandwich on it. And I was like, whoa, oh my gosh. And as he hands me the ham sandwich, he says, you know, I don't make lunch for anyone. I was like, oh, awkward. So I was eating my ham sandwich and he's sitting there like looking at me while I'm eating, but I was so hungry. And then I says, you know, young man, I have something very important to tell you. And I'm getting really excited because I'm being nourished by his sandwich. And now I'm going to receive his amazing wisdom, you know? And I was, said, make lots of money. And I was like, whoa, this is a downer. This is like Design Yoda sort of saying a dark thing to me. He said, yeah, make lots of money. I said, and he looked at my face and he said, I bet you weren't expecting me to say that. He said, in his 80 plus years of being alive and doing all kinds of creative work, he realized the following. He realized that the things that he makes, that he loves to make, often don't make any money. Whereas the things that he kind of doesn't really want to spend time on could make money. So he said, you have to make money with things you maybe don't want to make to pay for the things that you love to make your way. So he gave the example of, so how did you find my work? And I said, oh, I found your book in the library. It's called Paul Rand, A Designer's Art. And he says, right. Do you know how many colors that book was printed in? That book is printed in 5 colors, which for an old book, that's a very expensive thing. Books are generally printed single color. It was 4 color CMYK plus silver. I said, 5 colors, silver with a silver special color. He said, exactly. You have to know that the publisher refused to print 4 color with silver and demanded a 1 color print, 1 color print run. So he said he paid for the other colors. He wanted to make it his way. I've always thought about that. So rewinding back to your question, Katerina, I believe that when designers are able to control capital, or anyone who's creative can control capital, They can control what they want to make their way. That's a kind of creative power that I don't think anyone teaches you in art school or engineering school, that I think is fairly important. I strongly believe that knowledge of capital and how it works is able to let you control your destiny versus have it control you.
I love this story that you shared. And I think it says so much about Paul Rand as a person and why he was a great designer. Because I think when you understand what it takes to create a really good product and you're willing to sacrifice resources, time, whatever, to make it the way you want it, then your standards of the quality kind of constantly are at that level. But also I love the human part of the story that you shared, that he shared a sandwich with you and made you lunch. I think this is also something that great leaders and great creative leaders should be good at, being human and helping others. And I love this. How did you feel in that moment? What did you, first of all, apply his advice and made lots of money? And also, how did you, in introspection, how did you apply this?
Oh, well, I didn't understand it, actually. I didn't understand it till maybe 15 years later. I thought, like, wow, really? Is that the secret to life? And, you know, years later, I was like, oh, maybe he's right. You know, maybe he's right that, and I got my MBA as a hobby just to kind of break my fear of finances. And it really helped me. And I know it's helped other creative people who have managed to cross that boundary. The problem is that we're taught in the creative fields that money is bad. And so it's like dark or something. All the movies are always something bad about money. But I know that I got interested because so many financial people would say to me in my career, John, you're the creative person. Don't worry about the money. I'll worry about the money. And around the fifth person that said that to me, I started worrying about the money. And I was like, why shouldn't I be worrying about the money? What are you worrying on my behalf? Let me understand. It's like anyone who's done a print run before. If you do a print run, you want to go on press. You want to be there at 1 a.m. while it's being printed so you can actually see the press that you're using and, you know, give guy. You need to go beyond the boundary of how it's being made to understand how to improve it. So that's my own personal take.
If you had to give someone an advice and a sandwich right now with your wisdom of all the years, what would you tell them?
Oh, well, I don't know. We've entered a new era where access to knowledge is quite different. You can like spin up an AI persona and have it give you business advice. Now, that's new. I didn't have access to that 20 years ago. So I think I had to get a degree. I'm not sure if that's necessary anymore. I think access to counsel has changed. I do know having an interest in business is a good idea for every creative person, unless you're independently wealthy. If you're independently wealthy, it's not an issue.
Well, I think that's definitely good advice, something we believe in, that creatives should understand the world of business that will allow them to be more creative, as you said, whether it is earning capital that you can invest in your creative endeavors or just collaborating with business people.
Well summarized. Yeah, well summarized.
Talking about leadership, and I mean, you, an example of someone who had an incredible career and managed to lead in many different environments. What is, if you had to describe your philosophy or approach to leadership in a single tweet, how would you describe it?
I don't know. Changes. It's changed over time. I think in the past, I knew nothing about it. That's why I wrote a book about it, to better understand it and to reflect. That was Redesigning Leadership. And then over time, as I had the opportunity to lead people, I realized how hard it is for someone who makes things. People who make things are very used to making them with their own hands. They're going to take a piece of paper. They're going to fold it. They're going to add marks to it. It's a very direct manipulation of the medium. People leading people can't do that. HR won't let you touch people. it's like you can't like do anything like this. You have to do things by enabling people to do work, to sharing your vision as part of that process, to changing your vision as part of that process. It's a very different process. So I think today I feel good about leading people in a way that I definitely in the early years as a lone wolf, like creative person, had no idea how to get my mental hands around that.
What was the biggest mental shift to change that you had to make to be better at leadership?
I think in hindsight, I think that creative people are neat because they have ideas that are sometimes divergent. And I think really good innovative leaders have that ability. So shouldn't lose that. I think that what you have to build is an empathy for other people, similar to when you design things for other people, but slightly different. Because when I designed a spoon or a lamp, and I'll do user research or customer research, this is what people want. When you're designing things for teams to be able to work with, they are shopping for a job. And so if you think of the job as a product with a lot of customer research, your team, how do you improve that? That's one job you have to keep managing because a leader is keeping a team cohesive. At the same time, a leader has to lead them somewhere. Otherwise, your leadership time runs out. So you have to do both the activity of bringing people along, but going somewhere. The analogy that I like is I met this person who had just visited the U.S. Pentagon. I guess they had tours, maybe they don't have tours anymore, but they had tours. And she told me that the tour guide had a very special skill. Their special skill was that they could walk backwards down all the hallways and lead everyone down the hallway, like not running into any walls. I like this idea that a leader has to keep looking backwards towards their team to bring them along, but they also have to be going somewhere and not bump into the wall.
That is a beautiful metaphor. And in terms of, I suppose, your journey with leadership and with any leadership, I think you, as a leader, you go through a lot of hard situations and things that are uncomfortable or not easy. How do you make a decision in a situation where there is no clear right decision? It's a tough choice between suboptimal solutions. How do you go about tough decisions? Any mental model use, any process, how you start thinking about it?
Well, you know, when we first, you know, before the conversation started, you asked me, is it okay to talk about my failures, like being voted no confidence at Rhode Island School of Design? Or I got a lot of people are unhappy with me out there on the internet. I heard it said really well by someone named Marshall Ganz. He's like a leadership expert. He worked on the civil rights movement as a 20-year-old guy. He dropped out of Harvard, went to Mississippi in the 60s. And so really interesting kind of fellow. And he has some really interesting talks online. He has no big hit book with one word, like Sponge or like, you know, whatever, all these amazing, like, you know, bestseller books. But he's got some great stuff online that it's not packaged, but it's really nice. So Marshall Ganz, G-A-N-Z, look for Public Narrative. He argues that all leaders lead by being able to construct a narrative to enable to bring people along. And he also says that when everything is fine, nobody needs a leader. Like, what's the point of the leader if nothing is like not broken? Only in times when things are broken do you need a leader. So I argue that that kind of says that, of course, it's supposed to be hard if you're a leader being tasked with leading people. So that's a good thing. So I feel really glad that like when I became president of Rhode Island School of Design, I became president in the year 2008. which, if some of you remember, 2008 to 2009 was a global financial crisis. And my predecessor had borrowed a lot of money to buy a bunch of buildings. Oftentimes, university presidents like to buy buildings. In this case, the buildings were all bought on debt. I arrived with some new buildings on campus, and they were all with borrowed money. And then all of a sudden, everything is like collapsing. And so I had to rebalance the budget. I think I had to oversee the worst layoff in the history of the institution. I also noticed that the systems were antiquated. Like you send an email and, you know, 10 out of 11 emails don't go out. So I moved everything over to Google Apps for Education. I did a lot of radical things in my first year to kind of like make the institution operate more efficiently. I realized that art school is expensive and that many students were not getting scholarships. And so, and I did stupid things in the beginning that are useful to learn. I remember I asked for the top 100 students that got in, and because I wanted to call each one of them to congratulate them and welcome them. And so I had this list of phone numbers. And by the 90th caller, I realized that nobody could afford to come because we hadn't given up scholarships. And then the 92nd caller, you know, she picks up. This is like in the evening I was doing this. And it was a mother. And the mother said, "Is this really the president?" And she said, and I said, "Yes." "Is this a marketing stunt?" I said, "No, this is really me." I said, "Okay." And like in a mom voice, she said, "You must call back in 1 hour." I said, "Yes, ma'am." So I called back an hour later. And then he says, "Here, talk to my daughter." So the daughter gets on the phone and she says how, you know, she wanted to go to Rollins School of Design since she was like a teenager. And every year she would come to campus and dream of becoming a student. But this other school gave her a full scholarship and we didn't give her enough. So that's why she's going to the other one. I remember like hanging up. I was like crying because I realized this is so sad. I was going to do something so interesting and creative and curious, realizing, wow, we had failed so many people. So I gave my own scholarship that evening to change the game. And it pushed me to redesign how financial aid was delivered and to focus on scholarships. But it's a long way of saying, I changed a lot of things, the ways things happen. There was a famous move-in thing where all the parents would drive and move their children in if they were United States-based. And so I showed up in shorts and a t-shirt, and I would move them into the dormitories together, the boxes and stuff, because they're my customers. So I want to like do customer research. And it was fantastic. But I was often criticized for not being presidential. Anyway, it's a long way of saying a lot of experimentation is what I did to try to change things. And therefore, being as a leader, if you're changing things to react to an environment, you will be disliked. That's the way it works.
It's I love how you told this story and how personal you made it about being a president and giving away a scholarship because you knew that's the right thing to do. This is this is an incredible example of leadership. Talking about vote of non-confidence that you mentioned, because I feel like that's such a unique thing to go through and probably very traumatic and not very pleasant for anyone. But you survived and transformed the place and did so many great things. Could you tell a bit more about how it happened and how did you feel in the moment? And how did you get out of that at all?
Oh, well, you know, the CIA contacted me and asked me how I did that, actually. There's like a training program or something. I was in the 0.1% of presidents voted no confidence and the 0.001% that survived. I think I was just lucky. You know, I had made a variety of bets on turning things around. I had bet on advocating in the U.S. Congress to add art to STEM education, so-called STEM to STEAM, would be important. I spent 3 years doing that. The first year, people hated that I was doing it. Second year, they didn't like that. The third year, the people's children were coming home and saying, you know, mommy, daddy, I hear that RISD is leading steam. And it was like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. It's not John's idea. It's the school's idea, which it was. So things start to change gradually. Or like I was at a conference in the Valley, and then Jack Dorsey had just announced the Square mobile payments device. And so I went up to Jack and said, hey, can I give those away at commencement graduation ceremony? And he said, sure. So we had the most Squares on Earth for a time because they were all 3D printed. And so we gave those away at commencement and everybody hated it. Like, what is this thing? Like, I don't know why John's doing this, whatever. So that was the year one. Year two, we did that. Year three. And by year four, I was walking around campus and there was one professor that really disliked me. But I said, hey, John, we're going to have an exhibition and we have a pop-up shop, you know, because I like, they all know I like shopping because I love shopping. We have a pop-up shop. You want to come? I said, yeah. And you know, John, this year we're taking credit cards. And I said, wow, how do you do that? Well, there's this thing called a Square. I said, what is that? Tell me about that. And she perfectly described how it was. I said, awesome. I'll see you at the exhibition. I think that is a way success looks, I believe. So I would frame it as I was lucky because a few bets I had went the right direction. And I guess as an artist, I enjoy making moments. So I remember probably like the year before I left, you know, at commencement ceremony, when you're a president, you're wearing giant gowns, you know, all these gowns, whatever. But once you take them off and you enter the crowd, no one knows who you are. So I was like all done. I was walking to the crowds. And there was a conference center, three stories high with a long escalator, 1, 2, 3, 2, 1. So I got on the escalator and a young woman gets on the other side of the escalator with me. And she's graduated. She looks at me and says, are you the president? I said, yeah, you moved me in. My parents didn't believe you were the president. So we're like going down the escalator and parallel stairs all the way down. And it was kind of symbolic, you know, about the first floor, I shook her hand. And those are moments that, you know, take like 4 years. I think that kind of art construction always got me interested. But it's very hard leading change. It's very hard being disliked, being so-called punished when you do things the way that people don't like it to be. It's not for everyone. I cried a lot. I was very depressed a lot. But, you know, it worked out in a way that I think, generally speaking, was not bad.
Well, definitely not bad. And it's you're so right. I think it's the emotional roller coaster of leading change. I think for anyone can be a lot. So you have to be sure that that's what you accept and what you want. What helped you on this journey? Because it's not easy, as you said. I think every leader experienced one way of crying or feeling down. What in those moments where you really, really feel like you didn't do a good job or you have a self-doubt, what helps you in those moments?
Well, crying is okay because this is like, these things are designed to like produce tears. So I just want to note that if you cry, it's okay. If you're lucky to have a few good people that work with you along the way, it all matters. I got so many letters from the parents, like saying, go do that, go do that, go do that. I had a lot of students supporting me too. So I think there are always, if you're making change and you're making change that may be in the right direction, you have vocal detractors always, and you have less vocal supporters. And I think just knowing that you have supporters sometimes lets you manage that change. But leadership is a very solitary craft. I think of it like being a painter. I think you are alone in that. And hopefully it'll turn out.
You mentioned also in one of your tweets that it's important to be curious as a creative, and curiosity often may feel like a self-doubt because you're going to these unknown territories, I suppose. And especially with leadership, there are so many things that you will feel very much doubtful about, because you're doing something new and something different. So how a leader can balance the self-doubt with and curiosity while still maintaining the clarity, the accountability, the efficiency, and all the other things that everyone expects?
You know, some institutions are more open to a creative leader, some are not. Like a bank. Do you really want a creative leader leading a bank? Probably not. A hospital? Probably not. It's like, I remember like having surgery and then waking up from surgery, and the doctor is there. The doctor is looking over me and saying, you know, when we opened you up, it was very different than what we expected. So we got creative. I was like, no, I don't need that kind of creativity. In organizations that are seeking to change, they need a creative leader. They need someone who's more agile, someone's more curious about the world that's changing around them. And I don't think they get to last very long, is what I believe. A leader leading change, it is a tiring process that often they don't get to see the results of it, but that's what they were hired to do. So I think of it that way. Depends who your bosses are and the organization and the situation it's in. Even financial institutions have to get more creative given the change of digital transformation and AI. But that said, some industries have to anchor in a much more overconfident, that kind of perspective, because they have so much riding on it. So creativity is not for everyone.
Talking about creativity and design and the industry that is changing and has been changing, and you've seen a lot of changes already, and you can see how now it is changing even more. What do you think is the role of design or the role of creativity right now, and what might be in maybe 10 years in the future?
Oh, well, it is the most exciting time for creativity, because it's like the arts and crafts movement of the late 1800s. In Europe, there was the advent of textile machines, and textile machines are controlled by punch cards. So they are the first computational technology that we experienced during the Industrial Revolution. It was basically punch cards were the computer programs that made the textiles. And so there were a lot of textile workers were upset because it disrupted their craft. And so the so-called Luddites emerged as a group of people who were trying to destroy the textile mills, the textile milling machines. And so the arts and crafts movement was also a reaction of artisans who wanted to point out that we humans can make things better than machines in some cases. They're very expensive, however, but they're better than machines. And if you look at the artifacts of the arts and crafts movement, it's quite amazing. I think we've entered the arts and crafts movement of the century. And many creatives will be pushed to make things that technology has out of reach. I'm excited about that. What will we make that generative AI cannot generate so easily?
So what do you think would be the future of design? What do you predict in 10 years would happen with this?
I think a lot of it's going to stay the same. I remember being somewhere when I was younger, and I was concerned about stuff. I remember this, and this older gentleman in his 70s said to me, "Relax, kid. The world's always been falling apart." And I was like that. And it was sort of like, oh, you know, when you were younger, you had some kind of thing that was, I just want to point out that a lot of things don't change. I look forward to that. Some stuff will change. So I think the world of change is going to happen in anything involving making things is going to radically change. It's kind of like the desktop publishing revolutionized design. We have to remember there were people who hated computers, who refused to use computers because they loved rubber cement and they loved X-Acto knives. And this is how you do it. This is the way to do it. They're not around as much anymore. I liked a rubber cement. It was fun. It was messy, but I would not do that like now, you know, but maybe when I retire, I can do that too. So stuff will go away the same way that DTP changed a lot of things, I think.
The world of AI. And especially with the creative people. I think everyone is experimenting in many different ways. I think there are so many tools right now. And I like how you talk about AI being a co-pilot for anything that you're doing. So again, you have to know where you're going and you have to have some sort of vision. And that way you can really get the most out of AI as your co-pilot and your assistant. What would you say currently, if someone working in a creative team, would be the top three most useful things to do with AI, or the best ways to use it in everyday work?
I dropped in the channel. The best thing to do is to make with AI. So I dropped a link to this very short, it's like a limited short set of videos with computer code to let anyone create with AI. When you create with it, it kind of demystifies all the stuff you're using. I know for me, I'm not afraid of all these things because I understand how they work. And you can only understand how they work if you look at the code, run the code, change the code. And it's unusually easy to do so. So I would say you're asking like what three things you should do. You got to actually make an AI. I'm not saying go and use the outcome of AI, like use a Copilot or use a Figma plugin to generate or use Midjourney. That's more like, how does it work? You know, I had this print professor in graphics, and he always had this like this loop, this magnifier. It was like a, I think it was like a 20x magnifier. And I go to his office and he's like, come here, Mr. Miner. Come here. Look at the way the ink is bound to the paper. Look at it. I'm like, okay, I'm looking. So do you see how it is so different than this paper? I said, oh, I guess. What? Oh, yeah, it is different. Is that why it smears? Yes. You know, is that why this kind of ink is better than that kind of ink? Yes. And so you learn the craft when you make. So I think the code right now is important to experiment with, because then you're like, oh, is this how it works? Is that how it remembers things? Is this how it hallucinates? Is this how it stops hallucinating? Is this a local model? Is this a multimodal? Oh, it's that. When you can nod, then you're like, oh, it can't do that. Oh, it can do this. Well, if I can't do that, that's interesting as a creative person. So you can do more of that. That's the point, I think.
I think it's a great point, and I love that you're putting out so many different resources and educating about it, because you're right. If you're using as a co-pilot, you can't go back if you don't know how you got there. I think you were mentioning that in one of your sessions. So it's important to know how it is made so you can always go back or change anything if you want to be part of that process. And in terms of coding and technology, I think you've always been an advocate for it. Do you still believe that designers need to know how to code?
Oh, I think the old code is not as important as this new code. I think that this new code is very different. It's very inclusive, actually. You have to be algorithmically and process inclined. But you don't have to know the syntax of all these bizarre computer languages. It's a good time to learn right now.
And someone who is still resistant and believes that that will destroy creativity, we shouldn't go that way.
No, not saying that. I mean, that's the point of inclusivity and diverse modes of thinking. Like, I like people that like say this is not good for anything, because I'm like, maybe you're right. In which cases? I'm skeptical when someone says it's amazing. I'm like, well, for which case is it? You know? So it's always, I think my HR friend said to me that the key phrase you say in the HR profession is, it depends.
I think that's a good answer. It depends definitely applies to a lot of things.
I know someone also asked an MBA question. You know, I think having an MBA was useful. I don't know if it's as useful now, but if you're someone who works with a lot of people in business, I think it's worth it. There's one-year programs now too. So I think it just gives you creative confidence about things. And what it teaches you is that there are certain people who've been programmed to think that way. You're like, what? This is how you think? It's the same thing. I'm sure you've heard of people saying, like, I took an art class. What a different way of thinking. I think it's the same thing. I'm getting over the hurdle is a good idea. About seeing some cool examples. I guess my interest in things that are really different are in computer science, there's this phrase called abstractions. In design, it's called affordances, kind of, where it's the shape of something that can give you some signals or cues, and it's really good, but it's still abstract, but you can still understand it. I'm really impressed with the OpenAI Assistant API. I think it is a very good abstraction of a lot of ideas in this new kind of generative AI. I think it's beautifully designed. In terms of things that have excited me as non-super nerdy things, I spend so much time on Etsy. I'm so impressed that humans can keep inventing new ways to build tissue holders. Holy cow. I mean, there's so many variations. And so I don't mean to be silly, but I'm impressed that we keep inventing things in commoditized spaces that can still excite people. So that's where I'm at on that.
Brilliant. And while you mentioned the VA, I just have to jump into mini promotion because this is what we care about. And we do have a special MBA for creative people. That is not a boring version of what I suppose majority of MBAs have to be due to standardization of education. But we do have a wonderful one-year course for specifically senior creatives with 15, 20 years of experience who want to understand the world of CFOs and the business strategy and everything else. So do check it out. Talking about learning, what do you learn? And the reason why I ask this question, because one thing that is absolutely incredible and so inspiring about you that you constantly know so many things and you know about the latest things and it feels like you never stop learning, which is our slogan. But how do you, first of all, keep the curiosity, but also where and how in practicality do you learn every day?
Oh man, this AI thing is like amazing. Every hour, something just changed. I'm like, what? The pace of change is unbelievable. So I just spend all my time scanning YouTube, TikTok, X, Threads, just trying to find the latest thing. I've always been interested in that, so I'm not complaining. I think when I stop being interested in what's happening, I think it's over for me. So I do it all the time. Yeah, I'm like a teenager with a smartphone, pretty bad. But I have no parent to tell me I've been parent locked, so too bad.
So I assume you're not against screen time and kind of...
No. I turned that off a long time ago. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear that there are so many different ways to learn and get inspired.
Different ways, yeah.
But talking about the business and your own businesses as well, you're a board member in lots of companies.
Actually, I was, and I had to stop when I joined Publicis, but I was, and it was interesting.
How was it? And it's also very unusual to have a creative or tech person as a board member in general. How was it and what were you able to influence from the board level place?
When I worked with Sonos, the creative culture was something that mattered to the CEO. So things like that. I'm also in general an advocate for diversity and inclusion. So I think that is something that I enjoy doing. I'm a counter. You know, I'll count how many people are possibly gendered female versus possibly gendered male in a room to sort of make sure that it's a 50-50 ratio, because then I can tell if the room is dumb or smart.
Interesting.
Things like that.
Because I think world of board level is also a mystery to a lot of creators, because usually the interaction with the board is not the most fun one for majority of us. What would you say by being there and seeing it from the inside, if there are creatives who want to make a bigger influence with their thinking, with their work, how should they interact with board members to make the bigger impact?
I think having an MBA is useful in that, because I can read financial statements, and I think you have to be someone who can really like speak and understand fluently the language of business. So I think that was a prerequisite.
I could not agree more. I think this is something that I feel like more designers in general should learn for one reason or another. What currently is on your mind and something that you're curious
about?
Well,
what's on my mind is I love the chat feed, because it's like there are things that I've been thinking about, like the recent IDEO layoff.
Let's discuss.
That is like that's a great question. I actually, you know, I was thinking about that. I was like, what does that mean? You know, for those who know about it, there are those who have like never heard of IDEO, so that's two. But those who know, it's like the Beatles of design thinking or something, sort of aging out, maybe. Or I think it's like Sir Paul McCartney level, or I don't know. I was like, what does that mean? But when you think about it, it makes sense, especially with the advent of this new generative AI and large language model AI. A lot of the sort of slideware and consensusware and all of that, that market is all set to be disrupted. I think IDEO doing that just makes a lot of business sense. And I think the people who are educated IDEO, what a great business school. So I think it was a good idea to have IDEO. I think IDEO is going to probably morph into something even stronger. So I'm looking forward to that.
I'm also positive. I think every company goes through ups and downs and different modifications. So I do believe that it's an opportunity for any company to figure out how to get stronger from that point. What would you advise someone like IDEO or any company who wants to stay relevant and who wants to keep growing if they're going through this now? What would be the way to go forward from there?
I really think that, you know, having knowledge about how all this stuff works, the AI thing, is table stakes right now. So that's why, because it's going to change our ability to be more productive and more companies to be more productive, and it's going to be a tool for a long time going forward. It's going to get cheaper, more prevalent, a new kind of desktop publishing, I think I'll think of it that way, has landed for productivity. I think that this point in the chat channel about otherness. See, the problem about being creative is that you want to be outside the circle, but being outside the circle means you're so used to not wanting to be one of them, but you want to be one of them to do what you need to do, but you don't want to be one of them because you're supposed to be different. You're supposed to be divergent. If it's duck, 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 goose, you're supposed to be the goose. But the ducks don't like the goose. Hey, that goose, you're kind of taller than me, kind of thing. So a lot of friction's built into it. And you're the goose. You're like, whoa, I'm the goose. I am the goose. I love being the goose. But do I? That's why I switch a lot. I like to bridge by speaking to each kind of group or living in their shoes. I'm better than average at being able to hang out with them. But I'm never included. So that outsider point in the channel, I think creative people have to be comfortable being excluded in some way, because that's how they're able to generate new, interesting outsider ideas. It's why creative people like to hang out with each other. I like to say that engineers and designers are both introverts, but designers like to introvert together.
I love this quote, designers would like to introvert together. There should be a t-shirt, because people are asking about the future of UX and where would it all go? What's the most potential industry sector to UX designer who is already interested in business opening on UX space?
If I review things I've heard that I believe in, yes, you can do user research with agents and bots, but there's nothing like talking to a real human. I agree. So whatever businesses that recognize that a mixture of data-generated insights and real insights, I think that's a good place to be right now, because people are going to be less good at talking with real people because they're talking with too many bots, maybe. user research. I think content design, I'm thinking of UX design as, you know, content design and user research and product design and brand design. Content designers are, I think, in a good position to shape information architecture. because I think information architecture is an art, and the art requires a lot of understanding of the domain. You know, these foundation models are general knowledge. And so I think that anything that is not general knowledge still has a lead. Product design, I think, is going to change because as these systems can automatically generate a lot of the hardware, the end-to-end journey, I think that probably in a few years, the idea of a wire flow diagram, I think that probably doesn't exist in the future, because that's a one-to-many path, whereas we'll be able to do one-to-one paths, which are impossible to wire flow for individuals. I think marketing and brand design is going to have the hardest problem, because that is about speed, turnover, and increasingly personalization. So I think the marketing brand designers that are really good at personalization AI technologies are probably going to have a moment in their career. I look at all these different crafts as the foundation of a good product. I forgot, even like strategy as well. I think the business strategy, the person from ex-IDEO, ex-McKinsey, that's more of a product mindset. I think even the product manager craft is about to change. And I'm optimistic because, so when I wrote How to Speak Machine, I realized there are three properties to computation that make them special. The first one is it can loop forever and never gets tired. That's weird. The second thing is it can span infinite space and also manage infinitesimal detail at the same time. So you can search all the needles all the haystacks on Earth, find a needle, or you can like focus on one needle and the very pinhead and get that perfectly interesting and correct at the same time. That's weird. The third thing is that these systems can exhibit living properties, which in 2019, when the book came out, people thought that was a ridiculous idea. But now, so like 4 years later, okay, phew. But that second aspect, you'll be able to design the entire customer journey and every micro moment simultaneously with computational system and control. That's going to be very new.
Brilliant insights. And I think we're officially out of time. And I just want to thank you so much, John, for sharing this time with us and sharing your wisdom and perspective and your stories that are all about humanity and empathy and persistence and creativity and curiosity. So thank you for sharing your life with us. And I can see so many people thanking you as well from all parts of the world. So it's incredible that we have with you. Any last words you want to share? Any links, any resources, anything you want to wish to all the listeners and all the viewers who will find out about this?
Check out the Cozy AI Kitchen. There are going to be 6 episodes. It's limited edition. I don't know how it's out there, but check them out.
Thank you. Definitely check it out. Thanks, everyone.
Good night, everybody. Thank you, Dr. Jama.
Until next time.